now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Hello, good evening, good evening, good evening to everybody out there, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, finding your courage to be able to reclaim that which you have always been. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I want you to visit the website. It is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word right there. And just in case you cannot spend the full hour with me this evening, no worries, no worries at all, because these broadcasts are podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, you go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. Just go back on the website and just find the button that you can click on with the archives and pull up the show that you missed, or go back and listen to some previous shows that might have piqued your interest. And if you would like to call in and be a part of tonight's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I want you to give me your insights and your comments and your thoughts on tonight's subject, Weeping by the River, Beyond Mere Appearances. Well, now in my fifth year with BBS Radio, these broadcasts have always focused on the continued integration of spirituality and our mental health. And I place this integration all within the context of our relationship that we have with ourselves, others, and God or the divine. And this is a very essential integration of our spirituality and our mental health, because quite often our minds, powerful as they are, but our minds interpret what we take in through our senses and are based on our previous experiences, or let's say our education levels, our upbringing, and so forth. And sometimes our mind's interpretation really fails to capture a more accurate understanding of, let's say, deeper lessons that we need to learn in life, or the realities that might be a little distorted based on, again, our experiences. And being more mindful that there are greater truths out there, because our egos often take over and keep us from knowing ourselves as vast and eternal souls. I mean, that is our ultimate truth, knowing ourselves as a soul and the implications of, well, then, how do I live as a soul in this world and in relationships? Okay. Well, admittedly, as I said, it is our egos that lead us astray with all kinds of thoughts and maybe even selfish pursuits, you know, a lower level consciousness, if you will, which is all bound by time, space, and causation. And yet, how often are we guilty for not paying attention to our egos and our mind's distorted templates for teaching, you know, us something about ourselves and showing us where our healing and transformation are still needed? And this is exactly where the integration of spirituality and our mental health needs to begin. Because when we examine this integration, we come face to face with our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual woundedness in relationships. In fact, this is also where we come face to face with our ego, and we convince ourselves that, well, we're going to find happiness and joy and contentment only to discover that the larger the ego becomes, the greater the sorrows are sown. Because you see, eventually our egos bring us back to coming to terms with the relationships in our lives. You know, relationships that we, you know, with our families or coworkers or friends and other relationships. And it's kind of like holding up a mirror to us and just, ooh, okay, I don't really like what I see in terms of what the ego is showing me. But all is not lost because, again, that reflection back to us can certainly give us insights as to, like, okay, how do we heal this? How do we fully embrace ourselves as a soul and really limit just pretty much try to do away with the ego's, you know, tugging on us for attention, which probably lead us down the road of getting in trouble. So even with the people whom society, you know, says that are unlovable and unreachable and untouchable, we still have relationship because we have this shared humanity with one another. We just simply can't tell ourselves or tell other people, well, sorry, not my problem. We can't do that because to deny that kind of identifying with other human beings and to deny them the help is actually denying a huge part of who we are. But, you know, when we do the work of integrating healthier ways of suppressing the ego through embracing our value and dignity and worth as a soul, we transform. And we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding with things such as forgiveness and gratitude and love. Or as the Dutch priest and professor, who I really enjoy reading and reflecting on his work, Henry Nouwen, as he puts it, just by paying attention to what is going on around us, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds and forgive each other's offenses, who share their possessions and foster the spirit of community and celebrate the gifts that they have received and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. And ironically, tears are very much part of this sentiment by Henry Nouwen. So let's begin tonight's broadcast by looking at a very beautiful, very majestic tree that is found near creeks and rivers, namely the weeping willow tree. Now, I grew up around weeping willow trees, and some of my best memories are just, you know, I'd always hang out by a creek or if I could get close to a river. I just loved it. And this time of the year, you can always find someone who has tied a rope or a tire swing, let's say, to one of its sturdy branches. Of course, you know, as kids, we would always fight for who would go first, just, you know, to get a running start and swing out wide, and then, if we wanted to, drop into the water below. Or we would just, you know, keep on swinging. You know, it was just something about the branches that would hold us. We had every confidence in the world. Well, apart from being a kid's favorite homemade swing, weeping willows get their name for their branches that gently hang down. Like I said, very majestic. Which have often been described as resembling tears that are cascading down their long leaves. And this cascade makes it look like the tree is crying, which is, of course, how it got its name. But, you know, in many cultures, the weeping willow is a symbol of grief and mourning. For example, I did a little research in this area, and I discovered that in China and Turkey, weeping willow branches are sometimes used as cemetery ornaments to signify our grief for a loved one. In fact, the willow tree has a long history of spiritual connections and is referenced several times in the Bible. Again, for example, in Psalm 137, it states that there on the willow trees we hung up our harps. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and we wept when we remembered Zion. And elsewhere, in Ezekiel 17, verse 5, you know, it states that the prophet plants a seed, and sets it like a willow tree. And this, in its context, refers to the willow tree's long-held symbolism of rebirth and joy and vitality. And in Leviticus 23, verse, I think it's 40, it states that, "And you shall take on the first day the fruit of splendid trees, branches of palm trees and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days." So here again, you know, the willow tree or the willows are portrayed as celebratory, you know, with believers being told to bring the willow and other festive trees as a festival offering. Well, the willow tree is also a prominent feature in many European folklores. In fact, I found this quite interesting myself. This is where the famous phrase "knock on wood" came from, because people believed that, you know, that the bark of the willow tree brought good luck, and so that they would knock on its trunk, bring good fortune. And of course, if you've ever been around a weeping willow tree, you know, when the wind is blowing, just the sound of the wind blowing through a willow tree's leaves was said to be elves whispering to one another. And that's something that I'm going to have to do. I'll have to get out there and listen very carefully to see if the elves are whispering to one another. And this tree also, as I said just briefly a while ago, that it also embodies resilience and hope. And despite its sorrowful appearance, the weeping willow tree is really strong and adaptable. It's often found near water. I mean, for no small accident, you know, because it symbolizes the nourishment of the soul and the continuity of life. And so the willow tree and its branches are often seen as a symbolic representation of sorrow and mourning, but also they're seen as, you know, being full of symbolism that carries with it optimism, such as rebirth and vitality. So here's this integration theme coming up again as representing both sorrow and renewal. Well, in addition to researching weeping willow trees, I've also spent the last couple of weeks just being reminded of society's message, or the messages, I should say, out there regarding shedding tears. And you know, when we experience the loss of a loved one, or when, let's say, we are overcome by very strong emotions, joy, heartbreak, or so forth, tears are a natural way our bodies release built-up tension, and so forth. And yet, despite the many benefits of shedding tears, which I'll get into here in a little bit, there are still stigmas around crying in public. Okay, especially in pop culture, let's say. So, for example, anybody out there remember the song "Don't Cry Out Loud" by Melissa Manchester? You know, the refrain goes like this, you know, "Don't cry out loud, just keep it inside and learn how to hide your feelings. Fly high and proud, and if you should fall, remember you almost had it all." And this isn't the only song that talks about hiding your tears. I mean, there's, if you remember, if you're as old as I am, you'll remember the old Quarter Flash song called "Harden My Heart." And the lyrics go like this: "I'm going to harden my heart. I'm going to swallow my tears. I'm going to turn and leave you here." And I have to admit, I mean, these are pretty catchy tunes, but really bad messages regarding understanding tears in just a very negative light. Well, have you ever been so overcome with emotion that all you feel like doing was just sitting down and having a good cry? You know, one of those deep, heavy, sobbing cries, you know, whereby afterward you felt completely drained, you felt completely exhausted, and all you wanted to do was just simply sleep. Well, that's quite natural because, again, the built-up tension or the sorrow and so forth, and expressing the tears and that heavy sobbing cries will leave us drained. And the best thing we can do is maybe just sleep afterwards and drink lots of water, you know, flushing some things out of our system and restoring that vitality to us. Well, a lot of times we cannot express our feelings any other way except for tears because, well, admittedly, we just might find it too difficult to talk about our emotions. And whenever this occurs in sessions, you know, with clients, and a client cries in front of me, but they're silent, I always just ask them, you know, if those tears could talk, what would they say? Give your tears a voice. Give them permission to speak. What would they say if given the chance? Okay. And some very, you know, wonderful therapeutic insight comes as a result of just allowing our tears to have a voice, let's say. But have you ever noticed that there is this temptation out there to, well, I have to explain why a person is crying or why a person is sad? I don't know if you saw the Olympics. I think it was on the last day when the United States women's basketball team won the gold medal. And they're there up on the podium, all of them, and they all received their gold medals. And as the national anthem and the American flag was being raised, all the cameras seemed to be on Brittany Griner, who started to weep. And you could tell that that moment really touched her. But yet, afterwards, everybody was like, wow, did you see that? Did you see that? You know, and they just wanted to explain why she chose that moment to cry. Well, it's, you know, it could be very overwhelming, you know, and I think our national anthem, America's national anthem, is very beautiful. And in that moment, when you reflect on all your hard work and sacrifices and finally getting through all the competition and you are standing there and you know that you have achieved, that you are, you know, top in your sport. Of course, very natural to cry. But I've seen many, you know, I've seen this many times in people that whenever they begin to cry or they shed a few tears, they often immediately want to wipe them dry, or they often want to apologize for them. You know, in terms of like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cry, you know, let me just compose myself. You know, it's almost as if to shut them down. That is, if, you know, they might fear of, well, if I really get going, I may not be able to stop. Well, taking all of this into consideration, and despite these negative messages out there about tears, there are actually many benefits to crying. You know, tears, as researchers have shown, you know, tears contain stress hormones such as manganese and other toxins that can be flushed out of the body through crying. And tears also release oxytocin and endorphins. Those are the good molecules. We want those. You know, the chemicals that help relieve physical and emotional pain helps improve our mood and promote a sense of well-being, okay? And I know many women, and I have to go through the stories of women, who experience such a letdown of their emotions after they give birth and they're holding their child in their arms and they just sob and sob and sob, and it's just a release of tension, but it's also a release of oxytocin, which is often considered as the moral molecule, I believe, as I'm blanking on his name, but that is the title of, oh, I'm sorry, there it is, Paul Zak. Just looked over at my bookshelf, and there it was. He did studies in oxytocin and how that's released, and it creates such a bond in our relationships. And it comes through, let's say, appropriate physical touch or generous hugs. Or even tears, tears of joy or tears of sadness. It just releases, you know, the oxytocin and the endorphins, okay, which provide, you know, very soothing relief. And like I said, it promotes this sense of well-being. And tears can also activate our parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, and just jump into Psych 101 here. The sympathetic nervous system is our fight or flight system. We get ready for action. We're either going to fight, we're going to flee, or we're going to freeze. Okay, but everything's on high alert. Our muscles start to constrict, our eyes start to dilate, so on and so forth. But with tears, activating the parasympathetic nervous system, that's the system that we shift into that keeps us calm or brings us down from the sympathetic fight or flight nervous system. And so tears can activate this parasympathetic nervous system, which lowers heart rate, slows our breathing, lowers blood pressure, and restores the body to a state of balance, this equilibrium. Now, the notion that crying and shedding tears, may have a beneficial cathartic effect, actually goes back to the Greeks and the Romans. And even Freud wrote about a large part of an emotional disappearing if it is expressed, his words. And I found it fascinating that numerous surveys, today and questionnaire, that are based studies show that people feel better after crying, and not just in this country, because there was this international study, a large international study that had 4,200 young adults from 30 countries, and the majority reported that they felt better mentally and emotionally after crying compared to with how they felt before. And about 40% said that they felt the same, and then about 10% just said that they felt worse. But I just found it fascinating and just an extraordinarily large study that the majority said, yeah, I feel better after having a good cry. Well, in our house, we have this small plaque that reads, Live to the Point of Tears. Live to the Point of Tears. I love this saying because I use it as a point of meditation, whenever I see it. What does it mean to live to the point of tears? And whereas some people will see crying as a sign of weakness, that's not true. Because as you're living to the point of tears, crying is not a weakness, but it's a reminder not to hide yourself from the world's problems, but rather engage people where they live. Engage people where they live. And in doing so, you live to the point of tears. Well, another fascinating study was this groundbreaking work of Dr. Eric Linderman at Massachusetts General Hospital. It was way back in, like, I think the early 1940s or even maybe even like the 1938, 39, somewhere around there. Anyway, he treated people for ulcerative colitis. And he said that, a lot of people suffered with ulcerative colitis because they couldn't express their emotions. Okay, and they just may have lost loved ones and so forth, and they just had a hard time just readjusting to life without their loved one. And of course, holding it all in, you're going to get ulcerative colitis. Okay, that's a proven fact. That's just not me talking here. But in Linderman's life, 9 months later, and this is kind of ironic, he also sat with people and treated them. And these are the people who lost loved ones in the Coconut Grove nightclub, I can't talk, nightclub fire. There we go. Coconut Grove nightclub fire. And ironically, he saw the same ulcerative colitis symptoms from people who had lost loved ones in this fire, but were never able to grieve loved ones who died in the fire. Very tragic, very traumatic, and yet, again, can't express my pain, my sorrow, my loss, and eventually ulcerative colitis. And so he was one of the first doctors, in this country, way back in the 1940s, to make the connection between, our emotions and our mental state and our physical health. And so that's always good to know, you know, because again, we cannot separate those things. And I'm still fascinated to this day just how often our physical bodies are the first thing that raises a red flag and just says, "Up, oh, got a problem here. You better take care of this. If you don't, this is going to get worse." To anything, you know, mental health or you know, emotional health related. Well, I wanted to share with you just a brief story that taught me something about healing from within. And again, ears and just keep all of this in mind. I don't know if I've shared this with the audience before or not, but there is a scar on my left thumb. Okay, a scar. I was 17 at the time, and I was just working on a like a mock roofing project, but it was designed to teach us students how to shingle a roof properly. I mean, what they wouldn't let us go up on ladders, so we just had to do something on the ground. And my task was to cut smaller sections of shingles so that they would fit at the end of each row. And it was about an hour before quitting time, and of course, as with most avoidable accidents, you know, I was in a hurry to finish the job. And with my straight edge in one hand and my utility knife in the other, I began to score the sections that needed to be cut. And on the fourth pass, the knife seemed to jump across the straight edge and right across my left thumb. And so, needless to say, I finished the day in the emergency room getting about 7 stitches for my haste. Now, reflecting on that experience, it taught me a lot about the natural progression of recovering from painful experiences. Because whenever I was cut, I did experience the excruciating pain of a fresh wound. And in the days that followed, whenever I accidentally bumped my thumb, of course, the pain and the blood reminded me that although the wound was stitched, healing was still a long way off. And now, many, many decades later, I'm still reminded of that day, not because of the pain, because of the scar. And all of us have scars from previous wounds. Some are more obvious than others, such as a wound from, let's say, surgery, or in my case, an accident. And other scars, however, are not so obvious. And these scars that result from certain emotional and spiritual wounds are often kept hit deep within our hearts and our soul. I mean, very rarely do we permit others to touch these wounds because perhaps we never healed from them to begin with. And some wounds are still fresh, even from 5, 10, 15, or more years ago. And in these instances, a scar really has never formed because we've never allowed the healing process to take place. You know, because we're constantly either poking at the wound or we're scratching it open, you know, scratching open the scab, or we are reliving the painful memories all over again. And despite our mother's warnings that, you know, it'll never heal unless you stop picking at it, we still apply the temporary band-aids of prescription or illegal drugs and alcohol, and we want to repress or deny or, you know, look for some other sedating relief. Well, the same process of healing from within could be said regarding finding healing from the emotional wounds of loss and grief. However, a common misunderstanding is that once we have assimilated our losses, that we're going to go back to the way we were before the loss. You know, our original emotional, maybe even our spiritual state, our mental state, but this returning to the way things were doesn't happen. Okay, we think it's going to happen, but no. Instead, you know, we are constantly shaped and changed by our losses. And the reason for this is because once we have experienced a loss, our outlook on life is forever altered by the grief we sustain. And the reason for this is because our assumptions about life and the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. And we have become accustomed to the routines which define our, let's say, our daily existence. Well, furthermore, We're never going to see ourselves and others and or the world the same as we once did, because we're pulled into the task of trying to make sense out of new circumstances in light of the old. And yet, instead of assimilating our losses and, you know, into our everyday lives, many people still resist this healing by continuing to live in a prison of bitterness, reinforced by the familiar patterns of, let's say, abuse or low self-esteem or feelings of unworthiness or contempt or jealousy or strife. And instead of looking for the potential of being made better by our losses, we just might allow bitterness to harden our hearts and to keep others out, all the while cementing the anguish inside. So this challenge is then for us to discover the courage to be able to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and our grief. And yet still, once we undertake this, we are compelled to ask this one question. Is this whole integration process something that we can do on our own? Or do we need help from others? Well, I really love to hear your heart on this matter. So again, if you like to call in, be part of the show, that number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this break. So again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Howe. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Hey, everybody, welcome back. I am Dr. James Hauck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Welcome to the second half of the show this evening. And I just want to remind everybody that earlier in the show, I was talking about weeping willows and their symbolism of, you know, shedding tears, as well as this resiliency and building hope and moving forward. And it has a direct correlation out there in our understanding of how do we heal from our losses. And why there is such a necessity to shed tears, because, you know, shedding tears is not just negative. It's not just resulting from, let's say, a loss of a loved one or let down from tension, build up tension in our lives. But, you know, you and I both know, and maybe you've done this, we often shed tears of joy because something touches us deep within. And I wrapped up the first part of the show tonight by just looking at how our lives are forever altered by the grief that we sustain. And the whole reason for this is because, you know, what's really been challenged, if not shattered, are our assumptions about life, about the world in which we live, about who we are, or previously held notions of who we think we are, or other relationships, and so on and so forth. And we have become accustomed to the daily routines which define our existence. Okay, and you know, when something traumatic comes along, or death of a loved one, or we experience a traumatic event, whatever it is, the fact that we've become so accustomed to the routines, and our assumptions in and of themselves have just been forever challenged and shattered, this is the reason why we are never going to see ourselves and others and the world the same as we once did. Because now we're pulled into the task of trying to make sense out of the new circumstances in our lives in light of the old. And yet, this whole process of assimilating losses into our everyday lives and learning to heal from them and learning the lessons and making us wiser and so forth, many people resist this healing by, as I put it, continually wanting to live in a prison of bitterness that's reinforced by, you know, these familiar patterns of, let's say, abuse or low self-esteem or feelings of unworthiness or contempt or jealousy or strife. And it's really a challenge at times to look for the potential of being made better by our losses. And perhaps we can't see that immediately because all we feel is the pain. All we know is just, you know, what the heck just happened to us? How am I going to get through this? Or, you know, now what do I do? You know, we don't really see the wisdom yet or what, you know, teaches us something deeper about ourselves. If we remain open to that, those lessons will come later. We will find the answers. But a lot of people like to seal themselves off and just go within and stay within and harden their hearts. And as the song says, you know, harden your heart or swallow your tears. And keeping others out, all the while cementing this anguish inside. So I wrapped up the first half of the show with, you know, this challenge for us to discover the courage to, we have to be able to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and grief, which then brings us to this question, you know, this redefining ourselves, let's say, and this integration process, is this something that we can do on our own? Or do we need help from others? Well, as I shared in the first part of the show, you know, I have seven stitches, actually a scar from getting seven stitches, you know, when I was 17. And, you know, today, whenever I look at my thumb, I see more than just a scar or more than just a painful reminder of a painful time in my past. I also see a thumbprint. You know, something we all have in common with no two thumbprints being alike. No, it's what identifies us as unique among other characteristics. But these thumbprints are one of the most distinguishable parts of our physical being. You know, and hospitals record them as a means of identifying newborns and their mothers. Some even, you know, do, you know, a thumbprint of the fathers as well. And certain jobs require applicants to get fingerprinted before being employed. And even in, you know, people who have been arrested have their prints taken as a matter of legal record. So all in all, our fingerprints, our thumbprints, can tell us a lot about ourselves. Now, so do our scars. They identify what wounds we have suffered as a result of the past. Accidents, mistakes, surgeries, and unfortunate mishaps of maybe being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But you know, this same analogy could be said for our bereavement. You know, we all experience loss and grief throughout our lives, but just as no two thumbprints are alike, so too do no two people grieve in the same manner or react in similar ways to, you know, the parts of the loss that they experience. And let's be honest, you know, as a society, we could be doing a lot better with just bereavement. Oh, we've come a long way. I'll be the first one to say, yep, we've made great improvements, but we still can be doing a lot better in terms of bereavement. In our losses, you know, we may believe that what happens to us is just so exclusive that we forget about the other side of the thumb, let's say. But the fact is that, however, that change and loss and death are universal. And these are all events we face because we exist. It's this shared humanity again. And as universal as the events are in our lives of experiencing changes and loss and grief and death, we can never minimize another person's loss because it's still unique to them. Well, as I'd also mentioned earlier in the show, despite the negative messages about tears, there are tremendous healing properties of tears that far outweigh this temptation to want to suppress our tears, because these tears contain stress hormones or manganese and other toxins that need to be flushed out of the body through our tears. And tears also release oxytocin and endorphins, which are very good things, you know, that help relieve physical and emotional pain, improve mood, and promote a sense of well-being. And tears can also activate this parasympathetic nervous system of ours, which kicks in, lowers heart rate, lowers our breathing rate, lowers our blood pressure, and really restores the body to a state of equilibrium, this state of balance. And again, you know, we need to express tears because once we have experienced this loss, our outlook on life is forever altered. You know, I feel like I can't stress this enough. Again, this comes back to, you know, the question I posed that, you know, in working through our losses and coming to terms with our tears and picking up the pieces, let's say, of our lives that have been shattered after a loss or something traumatic or so forth, is this integration process something that we can do on our own, or do we need help from others? Well, I believe, even though we do the majority of the work ourselves, we do need help from others. We do need support from family members and friends, even coworkers. I mean, this is a study that I had seen in my own dissertation, that the more people have, let's say, social support during their times of losses, the more effectively they are at working through their pain, working through this process, and so forth. Okay. So keep in mind that just a very, very simple mantra, which was shared to me, one of my favorite teachers is Dr. Shep Jeffries, and taking a bereavement class from him was anything but a class. He made it so experiential because he forced us to come to terms with our losses. Okay. And so his mantra, which I have never forgotten, and I don't want you to forget this either, is simple yet so profound. Change equals loss equals grief. Change equals loss equals grief. You know, and we think about the changes in our lives, you know, we want to label them as good or bad, positive or negative, whatever they are, okay? Wherever there is a change in our lives, even things that we've worked for, such as graduations or a promotion at work or so forth, or even having children, you know, there is a change of what, you know, we once knew. And wherever there's a change, there is a sense of loss because, well, we can't go back to the way things were. And where there's a change and there's a sense of loss, we need to grieve that, even if the change is something we've worked hard for. Like even preparing for a wedding, it's still a loss of being single or the loss of the way things were. And we have to acknowledge that grief, that we're taking on something better, while at the same time, we realize that we have to go the past. Okay, so. In other words, you know, whenever we experience a loss, we can never return to the way things were. It just doesn't happen because, again, we are constantly shaped and changed by our losses. Well, when I was working on my dissertation, I met Ken Doka, D-O-K-A. And if that name rings a bell, he is a person who has done extensive research in the area of hospice. And as we sat in his office at the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, we talked about the importance of rebuilding our faith and philosophical assumptions that have been challenged by our losses and grief. And, you know, what impressed me the most about that conversation was how he explained how most of us live our lives according to our assumptions that, you know, grief will cause us to re-examine our core beliefs about how life ought to work or how life ought to operate. So from when we were young, our lives have been built upon assumptions about, again, how the world should work, when and how God should act, or other matters of faith like obedience and rewards and punishment and so on and so forth. Well, one of my favorite books is about an ancient story that is told of a spiritual journey of an Indian man called Siddhartha, who lived during the time of the Buddha. And with this particular story, you know, within Buddhism itself, there is a belief that there is nothing fixed and permanent in this world. In fact, everything and everyone is subject to change, or let's say, as the Buddha taught, is in a continuous becoming. And I like that. I love how he put that, a continuous becoming. And today we refer to this as impermanence. And if you ever sat beside a river, and maybe you're, you know, a little crazy out there and you want to swing out on a tire swing attached to a weeping willow branch, you know, and limbs, go right ahead. But if you've ever sat beside a river and watched its flow, you get the idea. You know, the water runs from point to point, you know, around rocks and fallen branches, and it always finds a way of least resistance. And yet at the same time, the river is not one continuous and unified flow. You know, the river of this moment, let's say, is not going to be the same as the river in the next moment. And, you know, this is where the saying comes from the ancient philosopher Heraclitus: you cannot step into the same river twice, for other waters are ever flowing onto you. I mean, that's humanity's wisdom. You just simply cannot step into the same river twice. This idea of impermanence or a continuous becoming. And this same philosophy can be applied to our lives, because none of us remain the same throughout our years. You know, we may think that we're not changing, but really, come on, we are. Various stages of life, let's say from childhood to adulthood to old age, not the same at any given time. You know, the child is not the same when he or she grows up and becomes a young adult, nor when he or she grows into the elderly years. And while it's true that we live from moment to moment, we tend to forget that each moment leads to the next. So impermanence and change are thus, you know, these undeniable truths of our existence. And another favorite book of mine comes from Joyce Rupp, R-U-P-P, Joyce Rupp, and the book that she wrote, Praying Our Goodbyes, A Spiritual Companion Through Life's Losses and Sorrows, or just simply Praying Our Goodbyes. And in that book, she notes that although we do it often, we're not very good at saying goodbye. She says that we typically say goodbye anywhere from, let's say, 20 to 30 times a day. And these goodbyes can include saying goodbye to loved ones as they go off to school or work, or saying goodbye to people we just run into at the grocery store, or even saying goodbye to another whom we've been talking to on the phone or texting or whatever. It's like, okay, see you later, bye. Yeah. And these goodbyes in and of themselves do not seem to trouble us, because we tell ourselves that, well, we'll see these people again, or you can always pick up the phone and call them and hear their voices one more time, or I can always text them tomorrow. Yet, what about the goodbyes in our lives that do trouble us, such as our farewells to loved ones upon their death? You know, these goodbyes may trouble us deeply, because we may not be ready to come to terms with the closure that the word means. You know, we want more time, and we want to be in charge of when and where, let's say, we take our leave from this world. And yet, a key component to any type of pain, you know, physical, emotional, mental, even spiritual, is loss and grief. You know, whenever we experience change in our lives, as I said, we're also going to experience a degree of loss from what was once familiar. And all these things could be, you know, negative or positive, things that we work hard for. You know, unfortunately, you know, this tension comes in with what most people fail to recognize. That is, in dealing with many life-changing events, we have this deep desire to remain with and to continually enjoy the familiar. And even though we may recall our struggles and let's say, heartbreaking moments in high school or college or any other times, you know, we might miss those days when our biggest concern was whether or not friends or sweethearts would notice acne on our faces. Or, you know, let's say in contrast to all that, other experiences, such as graduations or job promotion or even relocating, may bring anticipated excitement as we look forward to what lies ahead. But still, on the heights of this expectancy, things we worked hard for, we cannot overlook the fact that we also need to grieve the loss of what once was. So, whenever I counsel others in this area who are struggling with their symptoms of, say, depression, anxiety, and or general negative feelings about life itself, you know, sooner or later, the focus and the discussions turn back to loss. More than just the death of a loved one, there are other losses that we experience. And in reflection on these clients who come to me, I often ask myself, I wonder what losses have been the most difficult for them. How old were they when they had their first loss? Do they remember about it? How did they feel at the time? Maybe they were 5 or 6 or 9 or whatever, however old they were. And what part of themselves did they lose? And how much of themselves do they wish to have back again? All of these questions and more need to be answered throughout our lives, including coming to terms with also how unforgiveness and ungratefulness and bitterness may have been keeping us stifled in our pain and in our sorrow. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and I just wanted to say thank you for spending this hour with me. Thank you. You've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And just invite you to join me back here in 2 weeks when we're going to continue looking at other ways in which we can integrate our spirituality with our mental health. So in the meantime, everybody be safe out there. Everybody behave themselves out there. And keep working through your losses. And never, ever be ashamed of your tears, because there's tremendous healing. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.